Thank you to Rory and Colette and Councillor Tudor just to begin with. So we've got quite a lot to go through. So let's get straight into it. There are some trigger warnings with this, so everyone watching, please do pay attention to them. So we'll be talking about sexual practices with some explicit descriptions, and I'll be expecting you to imagine some scenarios. So it might get a bit uncomfortable. We'll briefly be talking about sexual assault, only briefly, but it's worth me mentioning that we'll go into that. And we'll be talking about shame quite a lot. Now, hopefully most of you will be comfortable talking about shame, but I know how triggering shame can be within itself. So if any of those are concerned to you, you might want to step away when they come up in the presentation. So the main aims and objectives for today are to empower you to explore sex more in therapy, to give you an introduction to sexual terms. So this is an introduction. It won't give you everything, but it will give you a good start. And then to expand your views of sex and sexuality away from a heteronormative model, to give you a brief introduction into cognitive behavioral, psychodynamic and person-centered approaches to sex and therapy, to offer you greater understanding of areas of shame linked to sex and why it's so important, and to give you a list of personal development takeaways and also therapeutic takeaways when working with clients. So an overview to begin with. A large proportion of people experience issues with sex and sexuality. It's very well evidenced, very well researched. Within the mental health profession, also within medical professions, there is a huge lacking of training around sex and sexual issues, and that goes for therapists as well. And yet sexual problems can contribute to depression, anxiety, trauma, eating disorders, substance abuse, pain disorders, etc., etc. And yet still, it remains fairly unaddressed in a therapist's office. There's some good piece of research I quoted there, Beulah 2016, if you want to check that out. So I kind of want to test you on some of those terms. I'm not going to go into all of these today, but if you do not know what they are, I advise you go away and start learning some of these. So I'll read some of them out. Kink. I think hopefully most people would know that. BDSM, which we'll explore a bit later. CBT, and I'm not talking about cognitive behavioral therapy. Age play, furry play, material play, object sexuality, voyeurism, frottage, put play, rubber play, cottaging, polyamory, and consensual non-monogamy. So we'll explore some of those today. If there's any you are thinking, what on earth is that? Go and find out. Be careful what you Google. So I'm just going to give you some advice there. But I'd suggest you need to start understanding some of this stuff if you're going to work with clients in sex. So the therapist, I don't know what training was like for you as a counsellor, but I know for myself, we're rarely given the opportunity to explore sex in training. And one of the biggest reasons professionals do not discuss sex is because of a lack of education, a lack of knowledge, and also discomfort. If you are a therapist and you want to work with sex, and how it tends to work at the moment is that you have to have specialist training, and I'll mention that in a minute. So again, from Beulah 2016, and this first sentence says it all to me. So a therapist's silence about sex in a therapy room sends many messages, but perhaps the loudest is please don't talk about sex. And there's some vignettes below. I'll just describe two of them. But these are actually from clients within this research. So since the therapist never asked about sex, the client got the message loud and clear. Sex is not spoken here. And the second one, a couple couldn't bring themselves to tell their uptight therapist that they enjoyed swinging in their early marriage. So clients will pick up discomfort from you. And if you're unwilling or unable to talk about sex, they will pick this up. And I've seen this many, many times. So we're going to do a quick exercise. So what I'd like you to do is close your eyes. And then I'm going to describe some scenarios. Now, these might be a little bit uncomfortable, so bear with me as I go through them. I have my own discomfort when I'm describing these scenarios. And I want you to pick up every time I add to the scenario or change it, where's your discomfort at? And has it changed? Is it becoming intolerable? to go through this scenario. Is it okay? Is it pleasurable? Is it shaming? So I'll start reading through them. Close your eyes and see how it feels. So the first scenario, imagine a woman on her own in her bedroom. Nice and simple. Next one, a woman on her own masturbating in her bedroom. Are you feeling uncomfortable yet? Is that okay? Now, imagine a man instead on his own masturbating in his bedroom. Is there a difference between a woman and a man in that scenario? And does your discomfort change between the two? Next, a woman on her own masturbating in her hotel room. Does it change again? Does that feel less acceptable to you? A woman masturbating in a hotel room with one man. How does that seem? A woman masturbating in a hotel room with two men watching. Is it feeling okay? Is it feeling unacceptable? Is it feeling unsafe? Is it feeling exciting? And then finally, a woman tied up with two men masturbating being filmed. Have you reached any discomfort yet? Have you noticed that? So what I'll ask you to do to take that exercise further is go and reflect on when your discomfort started to creep in, if it did, and if anything felt uncomfortable, unacceptable, you didn't want to imagine it, you wanted to stop doing the exercise, maybe it was all okay. So go and reflect on that. So we're going to look at some definitions now of sexual well-being, and this will form a really good basis for you as a therapist when working with clients. What I want you to start thinking about then critically, which we're going to come into later, is the heteronormativity of these kind of definitions, i.e. sexual well-being. So the WHO has a good definition, I'd say, it's improved, and I'll read that out. Sexual health is a state of physical, emotional, mental, and social well-being in relation to sexuality. It is not merely the absence of infection, dysfunction, or infirmity. So we're moving away from just the physical aspect of sexual well-being. I'm going to move on to number two. So sex is influenced by biological, psychological, social, economic, political, cultural, legal, historical, religious, and spiritual factors. And then we've got some other definitions, and I'm not going to read through all of them, but I really want you to pay attention here to where it's heteronormative and not heteronormative. And I'm going to give an example here. So number three, physical and psychological. So Martin, 2017, talks about the need for there to be physical and psychological well-being in terms of sex. And if you don't have both these factors, without it, you'll have poor sexual well-being. So you need the physical aspect, you need the psychological aspect to be well. It's great as a concept and it works overall, but where I want you to think a bit more critically as a therapist with this terminology, especially the physical, is that this is based on heteronormative relationships, and it's based on penis and vagina, and it's based on functioning sexual organs. And that is the definition Martin goes into in terms of the physical aspects. Now, we need to start thinking slightly outside of this box, because A, not everyone has physical or well-functioning sexual organs. Some people are born that way and grow to accept it. Other people may have physical injury, disease, etc., which means they then have to adapt to sexually function in a different way. I've worked with clients with alternative sexual organs that have sexual well-being. So in terms of that definition of you must have a well-functioning sexual organ in order to enjoy sexual pleasure, it's just not true anymore. And that's what we need to start get clients to understand, that there are alternatives, particularly if there's sexual function. And this is where you need to start challenging things with the therapist as well. So start challenging these models you might be reading about. And as some examples, this might include challenging views of partners, i.e. does there have to be a partner? Can it just be self-pleasure? And can there be multiple partners? Sexual organs I've talked about. Physical, non-physical sex. So people practice tantric sex, and non-physical, it may just involve self-pleasure, but it also doesn't necessarily include orgasm. penis vagina, trying to move away from this and the idea of intercourse as the only form of sex. And then relationships, lots of different types of relationships these days, not just monogamy, lots of different formats, and moving away from heteronormativity, difficult word to say. So you may have heard of something called the charmed circle. So here's an example of this developed by Rubin in 1984. And this starts building on that non-heteronormative model. In the center of the circle, if you can see, it's very tiny writing, I'm afraid. I've just noticed that. So I'm going to read some out. But in the center of the circle is the charmed element. And basically what that means, it's okay and it's acceptable by society. Bear in mind, this is 1984. But some examples in the middle are what's acceptable is married, it's heterosexual, bodies only, so not using any objects, at home, coupled, etc. As you move away from the center of the circle, away from the charmed circle, and you can apply this today, the further you move away, the less acceptable things become. And the lesser view society has on it. And the higher the distress starts to rise if you are experiencing such desires. And some examples on the outside of the circle are S&M, so sadomasochism, pornography. What else have we got in the park? So public sex, being promiscuous, bit of a data turn now, but by that, seeing more than one person. Sexual disorders. So they're not called sexual disorders anymore. And I'd like you to try and go and find out a bit more about this. But I do find clients are maybe self-diagnosing a bit more and might come to you with the new definitions. So instead of sexual disorders, The DSM-5 talks about paraphilic disorders now. And that is the simplest definition of that, and I've just put that at the start. A paraphilic disorder is A, it causes distress to the individual, and B, it causes harm without consent. So the full explanation and definition or diagnosis in DSM is A, feel personal distress about their interests, not merely distress resulting from society's disapproval, to personal distress. And then B, have a sexual desire or behavior that involves another person's psychological distress, injury or death, or desire for sexual behaviors involving unwilling persons, persons or persons unable to give legal consent. There are 8 key paraphilic disorders. And when I say key, they're put in there because they're considered some of the most common. And there's a 9th category saying other specified paraphilic disorder. I won't read through all of these, but just to pick a couple out, we have exhibitionistic disorder. What else have we got? Sexual masochism disorder, sexual sadism disorder. We also have paedophilic disorder now in the paraphilic categories. You might want to reflect on that and see how you feel. For me, I'm not sure if it should remain in the same category. I think it's maybe too close to some sexual preferences that are acceptable. But have a think about that and see what you think. But yeah, we've got paraphilic disorders now instead of sexual disorders. From the different perspectives, so different approaches and modalities, you might want to have some focus when working with paraphilias in these ways. So these are just some suggestions. So if you're a person-centered counsellor, you might look at the current experiential feelings of distress associated with a paraphilic disorder. So what distress is it causing them? And hopefully learn to move to a place of acceptance with these feelings of distress and soothe them. You might also look at exploring other ways to increase present satisfaction. So if they're unable to get satisfaction from that one desire, what other desires can they engage with to satisfy their needs? Psychodynamic approach, you might explore stages of development, so unresolved suppressed infantile perversions, which I'll talk about later, perversion being Freud's word, not mine, and then possible fixation stages. And connecting these experiences to key care relationships. And then for CBT, a little bit similar to some of this person-centered approach, maybe focusing a bit more on the behaviors that result from the emotional impacts, and then exploring triggers around the paraphilic disorders and maybe triggers that push people to engage in certain activities. So what I've also done, to go into a bit more detail with the different approaches, with person-centered, I've overlaid some of Roger's key theories and tried to create some of my own, so I hope that's helpful. But we can look at things like personal development theory, which hopefully most of you should know. But when we're looking at self-image, ideal self and self-worth, we can overlay them with sex. So, for example, you have sexual self-image, and that will be how we see ourselves sexually, good or bad, ugly, beautiful, including like body image, which are really important to sexual satisfaction, and how this influences our feelings and behaviors. We have the ideal sexual self, so the sexual person we would like to be. This is forever changing. This is also influenced by things such as porn, so it can change our ideal and make it maybe quite unrealistic in terms of sexual expectations. Sexual self-worth, what we think about our sexual selves, childhood influences and child formation. I also had a fourth circle. I've always done this, and this is societal self, because I believe there's quite a heavy societal influence, and especially with sex, on how we think society sees what we should be doing, if that makes sense. So societal sexual self gets influenced by the society around us, community, culture, religion, etc. You can also overlay this with the five characteristics of the fully sexually functioning person. This is really useful to do this when working with clients, and it might not be something you explicitly do with them in the counseling session, but you might reflect on this afterwards to see how sexually fulfilled they are, and how much further they need to go up that exponential curve. So you might look at things like open to experience and overlay it with sexual tones and reword it like being open to lean into positive and negative feelings, and therefore being able to recognize when they occur and understanding what sexual experiences are positive or negative, pleasurable or not. Existential living, not judging our own and others' sexual experiences, and being able to enjoy sexual experiences in the present and the moment, not necessarily always looking back at past sexual experiences or looking forward at future sexual experiences. And again, you're getting the idea now, hopefully, but I've overlaid sex with the other categories as well, so trusting feelings. That's really important, and it ties in with sexual dysfunction, which I'll talk about more later, but being able to trust what your body is telling you in the moment about what is enjoyable, what isn't, what's okay, what's not, and make the right sexual choices. Creativity, so being able to be sexually creative, absolutely integral to reducing shame levels as well, being able to be creative with sex. And then number five, fulfilled life, being happy and satisfied with our sexual choices, which can include no sex and different forms of sex, so i.e. being asexual. So that is a valid choice or way of being orientation. So psychodynamic approaches. I thought I'd start off with Oedipus complex, and in particular male Oedipal aggression. So this isn't well evidenced, by the way, and that there's some good research that shows this. But there are different ways to look at Oedipus aggression and why it's a thing. This is essentially the societal influence in gender, and men in particular, how they're brought up in a different society essentially to women, or different concepts of society, to engage with activities that display strength, to reject homosexual behavior, to reject femininity, to take control. And on the other side, women are generally taught to be more subservient, to get self-esteem from other people and men, to care, feelings, family. So this is where the psychodynamic approaches might explore how formation, personality formation, and gender influence actually begins to affect how we act and how gendered responses are formed around sex later on in life. Other psychodynamic approaches, which if you're a psychodynamic practitioner, hopefully you'll know this in and out. Essentially, Freud thought that human sexuality is disturbed, and that was a given, and it's libido-led, so it's not often about reproduction. He talks about children having sexual desires, and this is where things tend to develop. And if you link this up to paraphilias, I suppose if Freud was around now, he might connect paraphilias to this stage of development. He talks about infantile sexuality and how this becomes repressed into genital sex at a later stage. And that's when adult sexuality emerges. Infantile sexuality, by the way, not being the same as adult sexuality, it is different, but it might involve things like being stared at or looking. And I'll link that more later to sexual practice in adulthood. Infantile sexuality can become the dominant drive of sex, by the way. So Freud called this perversions, which is a word I used earlier, where something like voyeurism, being watched, gets fixated and moves into adulthood and becomes the fantasy, or as DSM would call it, if it is causing distress or distress and harm to other people, the paraphilia. Number six, we cannot clearly distinguish between normal and abnormal, by the way. So that Freud was really clear in this, and we have traits of both. Society is super complex, and it will also change our views of what is and isn't normal. And then the stages of sexual development, we have oral, anal, phallic, latency, so little or no sexual motivation, and then genital, penis, vagina. It's that genital stage to adulthood stage where the infantile desires then get suppressed. Psychedemics will work on exposing the dominant infantile desires to make sense of them, and then look at when these perhaps emerge and how you resolve them. That's, again, if you're a psychedemic practitioner, that's what you might do with a paraphilia. And then cognitive behavioral therapy, I've mentioned it earlier, but we're essentially looking at thoughts, feelings, physical sensations, behaviors around sex, and often these cycles that get in the way. A cognitive behavioral approach, and I'll give male dysfunction as an example. So if one of your clients is experiencing erectile dysfunction, what you might do with cognitive behavioral therapy is look at when the issue began and look at links between events, triggers, behaviors. Behaviors that typically emerge out of male dysfunction are avoidance as well. So once the erectile dysfunction starts and avoidance behaviors kick in order to reduce shame levels and not engage in that activity that increases shame. You might look then at goal setting, small immediate goals. You're not obviously going to set a goal to have an erection straight away. That would be the end goal, but you'll work on intermediate goals. And it might be kind of non-shaming physical contact that isn't necessarily about erection or orgasm or even intercourse. It's just about physical contact with their partner or whoever. You'd use things like tools and exercises, as I've just mentioned, the body contact, reducing avoidance, self-soothing behaviors, self-monitoring, and then possibly relaxation techniques. I wanted to give female dysfunction as an example in contrast to that. Again, similar, there's a really good model here, fear avoidance model, you might want to look at. But it's similar to male dysfunction. It starts when there was a penetration attempt and there was a negative experience. So it could be a high amount of pain or another shaming experience, catastrophizing thoughts, fear of penetration, pain, the avoidance activity kicks in, hypervigilance, and then tension. So this cycle here is actually talking about vaginismus and where that might begin. So I'm going to go into shame now. And the reason I'm spending a bit of time on shame is because it is integral when working with sex. I'm not saying everyone will experience shame, but most people do. So shame can be a big part of sexual dysfunction, or it can just be shame to talk about sex for most people, including therapists. And it's important to understand shame from different perspectives. So I'm going to give different examples of shame and what the flavor of them is like and what you might be able to do with them. So shame and sex for women. Really good article here that I've referenced, Gunning et al. 2020, but this talks about memorable messaging. And whilst this is just about women, and to note, this is about white women, heterosexual women, so it's quite a tight lens. Nevertheless, memorable messaging is important for everyone. And I'm going to explain a little bit more about this. So it gives examples of messages women receive when they're younger that has lasting implications on their identity, but not just their identity, it also impacts sexual activity. It's where a woman might be taught, for example, to protect themselves, to start a family, to serve or give pleasure, and that consequently can form the way they relate with sex and other people. And this might be because of belief bias, religious bias, moral implications, gender assumptions, which I've mentioned, and assumptions about sexual gratification. Key example of this is masturbation. Much more shame is experienced with women and masturbation than it is for men. Just a resource you might want to look at in case you are working with women with issues around masturbation and self-pleasure. There's a brilliant podcast called Ménage à Moi that I listen to myself, and I always recommend it to women. And it looks at reducing shame around particularly solo activities, but just sexual activities in general, and readjusting that memorable message. Body image, again, this one's about women, but what I'd like to mention is that this is a fast growing issue amongst men, and also particularly LGBT men. This article is a CBT evaluation of body image, and I think it gives you as a therapist a really good base point for how to look at body image and how to evaluate it. So I'm going to focus on the first three categories, but from a CBT perspective, it looks at the client's individual evaluative conception, I guess, of their body image, and this is how they view themselves and how they assess themselves. Then it looks at affective, so that it's the feelings that emerge from that, so how they feel about their own body, and then the behavioral. Really good example of this, and I've heard this many times from clients, particularly women, but other clients as well, will be something like wanting to turn the lights off all the time during sex, or maybe not wanting to lie in a certain position because they were concerned it was showing body fat. So that would be the behavior that kicks out of the poor body image. So if you're hearing things like this, lights off, lying in particular positions, you can already get a good sense that they've got low body image, and body image is directly connected to sexual satisfaction. Just to bring some of the other terms that I mentioned earlier, I wanted to mention polyamory as a growing type of relationship, but because the relationship discrimination experiences being in a polyamory relationship. So this piece of research that I've quoted, the definition of polyamory is the assumption that it is possible, valid, and worthwhile to maintain intimate, sexual, and or loving relationships with more than one person. And what we see more and more with polyamory, particularly as it's starting to come out, is more discrimination towards it. And this isn't just from society and outside either. So it's been well documented that therapists actually, as supportive as they might be towards polyamory, they're often the ones that try and advise or push clients back to a form of monogamy because they think polyamory is associated with damage and trauma. So be really aware of this as a therapist. So as I've just mentioned there, so the assumptions about polyamory also include lack of sexual health, emotional instability, negative personal characteristics, and also trauma. Shame and LGBT plus it really goes hand in hand. I identify as LGBT and I experience lots of shame in my life and still do. If you're working with LGBT plus clients, there will be shame there. It's almost guaranteed. And there will be shame associated with sex as well. You'll probably see more substance use with LGBT plus clients and even more substance use with sex because of shame association. So i.e. chem sex, sex parties with drugs, etc., etc. Bear in mind, this is different as well. So it depends on culture, countries of origin. I noticed with myself when I came out at a younger age, it's much more difficult at that time, much easier now for some people to come out, but there's still layers of shame. And depending where people are from, even more shame. Some countries aren't as ahead as we are in terms of homosexuality. The final thing I want you to consider with shame as well is men and masculinity. So there's been a lot of change in the world in the past few years, particularly around women, and a really positive change, and it's still moving. But what we are also seeing is increased shame in men around sex. You might notice this more with clients as they come forward. And this can be categorized into different areas. So men are now experiencing more shame around sexual experience distress, masturbation and pornography remorse. They feel more guilt and shame around that. Libido disdain, body dissatisfaction, which I mentioned earlier, which is growing amongst men. Dystonic sexual actualization. So this long term, but essentially it's a clash between sexual self-image and sexual orientation. It might be men, it might be hyper-masculine men that are gay and coming to terms with that. It also might be straight men that have some urges or fantasies around sex with men, but do not identify as gay and are not gay. So there's a clash between what's acceptable and not acceptable in their eyes. Sexual performance insecurity, which can cause erectile dysfunction. Perceived high libido, if they've got higher levels. Sexual harassment, stereotype threat. And homoerotic guardedness. You might be able to spot some of these things with the male clients you work with. And finally, on shame, and I'll discuss this briefly, but I'll put some references in there for you to go into. Kink and BDSM, and I wanted to give an example of the Grace Mullane murder that you may be aware of. And this happens repeatedly in our media. This was a case of a woman that was unfortunately murdered. And instead of the trial and the media focusing on the murder, they focus on the fact that she has had a kinky sexual lifestyle and was on BDSM sites. And they try to label her as responsible because of her sexual practices in terms of what happened. And that's the kind of shaming we see around kink and BDSM, that it's unsafe, it's dangerous. And actually, conversely, it's absolutely the opposite, that BDSM and kink practice is often safer. It's often has less STIs in terms of sexual practice. People have safe words, they have rules, they have discussions beforehand, but there's still this discrimination between kink and BDSM. You might work with clients that have a higher level of shame if they're discussing that their practices around kink and BDSM. BDSM, just a quick bit of background information, we're talking about things like play, power, mind, and sensation. And that's how it's often categorized. And it can emerge at a younger age. I mentioned earlier with psychodynamic theory. In terms of society's perceptions, as I've mentioned, it tends to view BDSM as a negative thing, unhealthy, maybe associated with abuse and trauma. And that's what you need to move away from as a therapist. Fantasy and trauma. So I just mentioned trauma, and I wanted to throw this in because people often ask me, or often associate, I'd say, a traumatic sexual experience at a young age associated with sexual fantasies at a later age. With women in the research I've mentioned here, this might be called something like women's sexual force fantasies. So there is some evidence, but only some, to suggest that an earlier sexual trauma may lead to a later adulthood sexual fantasy. But there's lots of examples where that doesn't happen. So as a therapist, do not assume if somebody's got a sexual fantasy, maybe a forceful sexual fantasy, that a trauma happened. At the same time, there might be a link, because sometimes that does happen in formation. Something I wanted to mention, GSRD. If you don't know what GSRD, you need to go out and find out. So gender, sex, relationship, diversity model. And there's a link there for you to follow. This is with BACP. And this was developed by Dr. Meg John Barker. Brilliant writings on our website and a fantastic piece with BACP. But this is a newer model of viewing gender, sex and relationships that is no longer heteronormative. And it moves away from things like sexual dysfunction. And it starts asking questions like, well, what really satisfies people? Can people have sex without orgasm? Can people have sex without intercourse? And there's a guidance there on BACP for therapists and how you might look at that. Charm Circle I mentioned earlier, and I just mentioned Meg John Barker. She developed a version 2 of this Charm Circle. I won't go through all of this now, but the link is on the website. So I'd advise you to look at the version 2 of the Charm Circle, which kind of reverses where the shame lies and what we should be moving towards. My own model of sexual acceptability, which is here, and it's in very small writing, so you may not be able to see it, but this is starting to identify that charm circle in the middle, which would line up with the heteronormative and acceptable section at the top. There's different layers to sexual acceptability in society now. So there's not just an acceptable and acceptable. What we are seeing more of is that we have an acceptable stage, that's heteronormative. And then it moves into a transgressive but acceptable stage beyond that. So transgressive being pushing societal norms, but it's acceptable and it's considered moral, pleasurable, but for most people it's unknown. So this might be things like group sex. It's still considered things like homosexuality, that it's acceptable but unknown to most people. It might be the use of objects like dildos and other objects. And then the next stage is transgressive again. It's pushing social norms, what it's deemed unacceptable by society. So it's immoral, potentially disgusting, unknown. This might be larger groups of people, so orgies. It's also transsexuality. It probably sits in this category for most people, which I don't agree with, but it's there. It might be for many, so it might be sex working. The final category to look at is coercive and illegal. So that's as it says in the tin. So there's no consent and it is legal practice. So we're looking at things like rape, paedophilia, bestiality, etc. Some key takeaways then. So I think the best thing you can do as a therapist is to look at yourself. And I'd want you to try and expand your understanding of sex and sexuality and do that first by gaining knowledge. So lots of things mentioned today, if you do not understand them, go away and find out. Don't expect your client to tell you. It's repeated again and again and again that this happens within therapy and clients do not want to do it. They'll give you limited information, but they want you to know. And then I want you to start thinking about sex not just being penis and vagina, particularly when working with dysfunction, where you have to support clients to find other forms of pleasure. I want you to explore your own sexuality, so understand your discomforts, reflect on that exercise we did earlier and see where your discomforts kick in, your boundaries, your levels of disgust, because they might be there. Body image. Do you have body image concerns? Will you possibly project that onto clients? Think about that. Sexual efficacy. Explore this in therapy, on your own, and talk to other people about it. Be honest about your phobias and isms. They will be there. We will have judgments. We will assume. You may have a lacking of culture awareness. Go away and discuss that again in therapy and supervision. To mention a second time, please look at that GSRD link. That will start to kind of progress you to a different way of thinking about sex. And then your key takeaways in terms of working with clients. Start to think about sexual dysfunction. I think this is the best way I can put it, as sexual communication. So, and I'm going to give the example of erectile dysfunction with a male client. There'll be a hell of a lot of shame involved in that. And viewing it as something wrong, as a dysfunction, is not going to help. Start to view it as communication. What is the body telling the individual? It may be telling them there is something physically wrong and they need to go and get that checked out medically. Or it may be telling them that there's something they're very unsatisfied with, uncomfortable with, anxious. So consider it sexual communication, and that can be a really positive way of framing it. Explore memorable messaging. So I talked about that with women, but explore that with everyone. What are the messages they're telling themselves, maybe about themselves? In terms of body image, they might be saying they're disgusting. And I hear that a lot from women, but explore that more. Number three, ask your client about sex early on. So once the relationship is comfortable, just ask them. Clients want to be asked. If you don't ask and if you remain silent as a therapist, the client will start to assume that you are uncomfortable to talk about sex. So if they're talking about a relationship, for example, so they might be saying there's relationship issues, ask them, okay, so what's the sex like? Are there issues in terms of sex? Number four, be curious. Be absolutely curious about everything, but please be relevant as well. Let the client lead you. Don't let your curiosity lead them. Normalize discomfort. So I'm talking about yours as well as theirs. Use their language if possible. This is a little bit jovial, but I'm saying it anyway. Dick means dick. So if they're saying dick, then if you can use the same word, if you're uncomfortable using that word, you don't obviously have to say, but make sure you validate theirs. You might want to explain that I'm uncomfortable using that word. I'm going to use this, but I'm absolutely comfortable with you using that word. So use their language where possible. Do not expect your client to educate you. Educate yourself between sessions. Normalize. Keep doing it. Normalize sexual issues. So many people have them. Normalize sexual dysfunctions. Gently unwrap shame. So if you can start to unpack shame, you'll start to unpack a huge part of the sexual dysfunction, sexual issues, but doing it gently. And then know your position also on adult and child safeguarding. It's something I advise many counselors on. And I often see, I guess, an unknowing around safeguarding in terms of sex and what counselors should do. This idea to kind of protect the relationship so much that we avoid safeguarding issues. So please understand your positions on vulnerable adult and child safeguarding. And know what to do if something comes up. That is everything. I hope you got what you needed. I hope that was a good oversight. Please go away and find out more about these topics.